From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump tweeted out a video message urging safety as Hurricane Florence continues its path to the East Coast.
Get out of its way. Don't play games with it. It's a big one. Maybe as big as they've seen. And tremendous amounts of water. The storm will come. It will go. We want everybody to be safe.
Florence is coming, but maybe a little later, maybe a little further south than we thought earlier in the week. Let's bring in NPR national correspondent Greg Allen. He's in coastal Wilmington, North Carolina. Greg, what are you hearing about landfall, about, you know, bullseye? It could change, but where are we now?
Right, Robin. The meteorologists say over and over again that we shouldn't focus on the track itself because the impacts are going to be so great of this storm. You know, hundreds of miles of coastline, storm surge, rainfall being the really some of the biggest worries. However, that said, it is kind of baffling now what's going to be happening as it gets closer to the shoreline. As it looks like what meteorologists are saying from the various models that it's going to stall out and start to drift perhaps south. So it's possible it might come ashore a little closer to the North Carolina-South Carolina border, which would bring greater impacts into South Carolina. You know, it makes the governor seem very smart for evacuating all those coastal counties when we thought it was hitting North Carolina, because the impacts are going to be significant down there.
Well, and it might impact as it goes, you know, as it moves south, Georgia, Florida maybe. So keeping an eye on that. And you mentioned it might stall and pound the Carolinas coast before landfall. Not good, of course, because that's when hurricanes suck up water. But it is going to bring what the government calls life-threatening storm surge. This is that ocean water pushing up over seawalls, a huge problem. What are people doing? Are they largely leaving?
I think they are, yes. And, you know, on that issue, it's taken a lot longer for it to get here than we thought originally. Now we're talking about landfall coming ashore sometime on Saturday, which gives people more time to prepare. In this area in Wilmington, North Carolina, clearly, a lot of people have evacuated here. The local officials just had a briefing where they said they're pleased with the evacuation. This area is under just a voluntary evacuation. They say many people have left. In North Carolina, it's really just the barrier islands that have been mandatory evacuation orders have been given for them. We believe people have mostly left there. In South Carolina, the governor ordered evacuation for all the coastal counties. So people are leaving, and they have time to still leave. Some shelters in the area are already full. They've opened other shelters. So it's clear people are taking this very seriously.
Yeah. And so a little further south, perhaps, and maybe not as, you know, no sooner than Saturday. So people are going to be nerve-wracked in shelters until then, it sounds like. Just talk, though, about what the expectation is of the rain, of the winds. I mean, they were talking about it possibly going to a Category 5. What's the sense now?
Right. Well, as it gets closer to the shore, the National Hurricane Center is saying that they do expect it to strengthen. There are some people who say it's possible to get to 5. Now we're at Category 4, which is, you know, between 129 and 155 miles per hour. I believe, and so right now we're around 130 miles per hour. But it's the belief is also that as it gets really close to shore and it starts to stall, it's going to lose a little power. Mm-hmm. So it's not clear exactly what's going to happen in terms of what level it's at when it comes ashore. But again, the National Hurricane Center and meteorologists say don't focus on that. The storm surge is going to be just as powerful because it's had so much time to build. It's going to bring this 6 to 12 foot storm surge along many areas of the coast. And then as we were talking about the rainfall, you know, 20 to 30 inches, the Hurricane Center says maybe 40 inches in some places. So we're starting to think about Harvey last year in Houston with those numbers.
Oh, tough. Look, Greg, we just heard the president say the exact right thing. You know, get out of the way. Don't play games with this. It's a big one. But as you well know, last night he also spoke about his administration's track record with regard to last year's hurricanes, including what he said was unappreciated, unsung, great job in Puerto Rico. The mayor of San Juan tweeted in response, you know, 3,000 people died, way more than the government said originally. You covered those storms. What do you make of those claims in the middle of looking at another storm coming in?
You know, the president's assessment, I don't think, is shared by that many people in Puerto Rico or really many people who follow the storm closely. Because, you know, it was a terrible natural disaster. As the governor of Puerto Rico reiterated, he calls it the worst national disaster in U.S. history. I mean, President Trump talked about it's not a total terrible catastrophe like Katrina. Well, I think many people would say they're comparable. You had 3,000 people nearly died in Maria versus nearly 2,000 in Katrina. In Maria, you had people without power for many people, thousands of people without power. For 6 months or longer, you know, so it's a tough situation.
It's obvious that the government wants to get out ahead of Florence as she comes in. NPR's Greg Allen, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So we will keep following the track of that storm as it gets closer to land. But, you know, we've also been tracking the long reach of the 2008 financial crisis this week, which marks its 10th anniversary with the collapse of Lehman Brothers later this week. On Monday, I was reunited with Lynn and Milo White, who lost their family home near Phoenix to foreclosure. I met them back in 2009 and followed their story for about 2 years. And Milo reminded me this week how hard losing the house was on his kids.
I think that they all lost a sense of home, really, a place that you can call home, that you can go home to. I think Michele really suffered the most.
Michele White was a sophomore in high school when we first met. She's now 24 and a recent graduate from the University of Utah. I was happy to learn that she made an unexpected trip to the studio with her parents when they sat down to speak with me. So after I got an update from Lynn and Milo, I asked Michele how she was doing after all these years.
I'm doing well. I just graduated college, and a lot has changed in the last 10 years.
Yeah, that is for sure. What are you doing now? Are you working?
So I was working. I mostly worked full-time. I went to school full-time all through college, it took me 5.5 years, I believe. So I'm taking a little bit of a break. I saved up some money, and I'm just doing ceramics right now. I enjoy doing pottery and kind of selling that as I can and just taking it easy.
So how did you pay for college? You know, your parents went through a major financial crisis. I'm sure they probably weren't able to help you very much. I don't know. But how did you handle that financially?
That was extremely difficult. Financial aid, FAFSA, doesn't take into consideration if your parents have filed for bankruptcy, and they require you to file under them until age 24, which is how old I am right now. So up until my last semester of college, I was relying solely on student loans. I got no grants. Even though my parents couldn't pay anything, FAFSA was assuming that they were contributing, I believe, close to $16,000 a year for my tuition.
Because of how much money their jobs were bringing in every year, even though they were struggling to recover from the bankruptcy.
That's correct, yeah.
Huh. So what did that mean for you? I mean, now you're in debt. How much debt are you in?
I believe it's just over $30,000.
Wow. Did that worry you, especially knowing, you know, your family's background with the bankruptcy, with the housing crisis? I mean, I'm sure that's not how you wanted to start your time after college.
Yeah, it's definitely not how I planned or envisioned this happening. I am worried. I kind of tried not to think about it while I was going through school, and I just graduated last month, and so it's kind of hitting me now. I was just doing whatever I could do in order to get through college and get a degree, you know, and now I kind of have to face the reality of how much debt I'm in, and I definitely need to get a job soon and have stability to be able to pay the monthly loans that the government requires you to pay on student debt.
Do you remember the day we met? Although it's many years ago.
It's a little bit foggy, but I remember, I think, a little bit.
You ran up the stairs when I tried to ask you how the family finances were affecting you. You were in high school. I mean, who would blame you? But I mean, just now that you're an adult, you've graduated from college, you have some perspective on all of this. What are your thoughts on the way the housing crisis is still permeating through people's lives, even though we appear to be in this beautiful recovery?
I think a lot of people in the country think that we're kind of past it. Even when they bring up like 2008 financial crisis, there was a movie about it recently that I went to see with some friends, and it kind of hit home. Like, it was just people watching like my life on the screen, you know, like how much it affected my family. And it's still affecting. At that point, my parents were still paying their bankruptcy payment. And, you know, here I am very far in debt with school. And I think a lot of people think that it's just recovered and it hasn't. Mm. There's still damage being done. And so it does seem a little bit personal that a lot of people have moved past it, but I don't think we ever will.
Your parents have told me that we'll never be in a position again to buy a house. What about you? I mean, does that the idea of taking the risk to buy a house make sense to you at all?
It scares me a lot. And I think about it sometimes as like the American dream. It would be great to buy a house with my partner and like not have to worry. And it is kind of always in the back of my head. Like, our family seems so stable and we did not see this coming, that it could always turn around. So right now, of course, I'm renting. I think my generation, millennials, a lot of people have come to the terms with the fact that maybe we never will own homes. And I kind of joke about if I own a home, it's going to be a tiny home because it's the only mortgage I would be able to pay.
All right. Michaela White, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Yesterday, our own Jeremy Hobson spoke with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson about his new book, Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military. The book is out this week. And after asking about the creation of the Space Force that President Trump has proposed, Jeremy had more questions for one of the best-known astrophysicists in the world. So let's pick up where they left off.
Now, we're talking about a new branch of the military. It seems that the current strategy on the part of the United States is to move toward privatization of a lot of space exploration. What does that mean for you if we do move more of our space exploration into private companies? How does that work with the idea that space is an important part of the military?
So that's a great question. So I have to clarify a couple of things that are not often clarified in the press, and that is private enterprise, based on my read of history, will never lead a venture into space that has never been conducted before. Things you've never done before that are expensive and dangerous and have uncertain returns on investment are simply not done by corporate entities. They're done by entities that have a longer baseline of return on the investment that they can recognize, and that would be nations, right? The first Europeans to the New World were not the Dutch East India Trading Company. It was Columbus, sent by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand to find a shorter trade route to the Far East. And once he's there and he knows how big the Earth is and how long it takes and where the hostels and the friendlies and the trade winds and the food, then you come back. Now you have information that can be used to assist an economic venture. So it's not really true that Elon Musk is going to send the first astronauts to Mars on his own dime. Oh, excuse me. You could do it as a vanity project. He could get together with Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, and they could just do it and drop, $100 billion to do it, whatever it'll cost. But that's not a business model. And they would be criticized by investors for having spent their money that way. So what you do is, here's how that could happen. The United States says we need to put a military base on Mars in reaction to some geopolitical force. Oh, we don't have a rocket that'll do that. Oh, SpaceX rolls out a Mars rocket. Thank you, SpaceX. We will buy your rocket from you and we will send our astronauts to Mars on it. That's how Elon can get to Mars, because we'd be paying for it.
How are we doing when it comes to competition with China and Russia and other countries, by the way, India, in space exploration?
I was just in China visiting the largest telescope in the world. They've got the largest telescope in the world. And I came through the Shanghai airport where there's a sign that says, oh, bathrooms are this way and stairs are that way. Oh, and the maglev is this way.
Right. It's very fast, like 400 kilometers an hour or something.
Thank you. It's the maglev on the same sign as the bathroom and the stairs. And I'm thinking, if I had a maglev, it'd be the biggest freaking sign in the airport. So there's a magnetically levitated train that goes, several hundred kilometers an hour, and it goes from the airport to the city in just a matter of minutes. And so I'm disappointed that here we are in the United States arguing over who's going to build a wall and who, you know, what immigrant is coming in or not, when there are large issues related to things like infrastructure and energy policy and food management and research in the frontier of science, technology, engineering, and math, which will fuel tomorrow's economic growth. Without that, you know, we'll just watch the rest of the world pass us by, as they're kind of already doing. We're becoming less and less relevant on the world stage. So I fear for the future of the United States.
If we do encounter aliens, how likely do you think it is that we'll get into? Well, how likely do you think it is that we'll get into a fight with them?
Oh, if they come to us, you know, you ever see a sci-fi movie where some alien thing shows up, and it's some huge spaceship, and people pull out their gun and shoot at it?
No,
and I just laugh. I say, people, they came here in a spaceship from deep space. You think your gun is going to have any effect on them at all? And so
they have a force field around them. It's not going to work. Right.
Thank you. And this is me arguing at movies, right? So if they come here, they are certainly more technologically advanced than we are. If they treat us the way we treat one another, then they will completely exploit us, enslave us, put us on reservations, slaughter us. They will have their way with us if they treat us the way we humans have treated each other in the history of civilization. So we should hope that they are kinder and gentler than we are in dealing with us.
You talk about a lot of different inventions over time in this book, things that I don't even think about anymore, but like the telescope and, you know, radio waves and stuff like that, right? I mean, which I use every day, but it's like that is really every an amazing day. Thing that somebody
had to
came up with that.
Discover this stuff. So, somebody discovered infrared.
Right.
I got to briefly tell you that experiment. It was brilliant. It was William Herschel. He's got this rainbow coming through the prism and the light through the window. He says, first brilliant point is, I wonder if the different colors of light have different temperatures. Mm-hmm. First, he's got to have that thought. So then he lays down thermometers in the different colors. But now he needs a control thermometer. So he puts it off to the side of the red part of the spectrum where there's no light. And now he measures the thermometers. And the highest temperature he recorded was the control thermometer off to the side of the red. That was not room temperature. It was something even higher. Mm-hmm. And he says, whoa, something's coming through that light and that prism that's landing there that I can't see. He uses the phrase unfit for vision. There is energy unfit for vision coming in below the red part of the spectrum, infrared. That was the discovery of infrared light.
So the question I was going to ask you is there something
–
now maybe
you.
I know the answer to it. Maybe it's infrared light. But is there something along the way that you've discovered that you think to yourself – how in the world did someone figure this out?
Well, so I read a lot in the history of people figuring stuff out. Sometimes it's serendipitous. Other times it's insight that's purposefully driven. Isaac Newton is a good example of that. And so, yeah, I marvel in the brilliance of those who have come before us just trying to decode the operations of nature. And we would later exploit them. Clever engineers say, I can exploit that new phenomenon that you just measured in some way that can serve us. I'll give you an example. My physics professor in college was an expert on nuclei of atoms in space. And in so doing, he discovered a new physical phenomenon called nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. It was a clever technologist who said, oh my gosh, I can make a machine using that principle and analyze your body and figure out what kinds of atoms are in what places in your soft tissue. Thus was born the magnetic resonance imager. Mm-hmm. Arguably one of the best tools in the arsenal of the doctor to analyze the condition of your body without cutting you open. That's based on a principle of physics discovered by a physicist who had no interest in medicine.
I want to ask you one more thing, which is, you know, scientists, and I've got two step-parents who are both physicists, and we've talked about this, that they have a hard time convincing members of Congress or lawmakers of why their research is important, why it needs to be funded, because a lot of these people they're not scientists. I mean, a lot of our listeners, I'm not a scientist. It's hard to understand some of this stuff. You have become one of the preeminent scientists who can communicate with the masses. How important is that? Do you think there need to be more people like you that do what you do?
Should be thousands of people like me. I think there's tons of articulate scientists. Our profession, however, in general, does not reward us for being articulate in ways that take us outside of the laboratory. Mm-hmm. My field, we have the benefit of having had Carl Sagan clear some of the brush and bramble of this attitude against reaching for the public. Can you still be respected if you appear on The Tonight Show? Can you still be respected if you you're a character in a cartoon? And that's an interesting question. And in my field, I've done all of those things. And as best as I can tell, I'm still respected, in part because I'm trying to lift all boats, raise science literacy of the entire electorate, so that when anyone comes back to their representative or to their community, they'll say, oh, are you doing that work? I saw Tyson talk about it. That's great. I want more of it. Mm. And if you're doing tax-based sourced science, as astrophysicists do, our monies come from primarily the National Science Foundation and from NASA. Both of them are funded by – the TILs are funded by tax monies. If that's the case, you have the right to know. I have the obligation to tell you, and you have the right to know how that money is being spent. And so I would do so without hesitation, sharing what the thrills of this. And this is what Carl Sagan did brilliantly in his original Cosmos and in all the books that surrounded it.
That's Neil deGrasse Tyson, whose new book is called Accessory to War, written with Avis Lang. Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The head of the FDA is considering a ban on flavored e-cigarettes. Commissioner Scott Gottlieb cited a dramatic rise in teenagers vaping, and he's giving e-cigarette companies 60 days to submit plans for reducing teen use. The Wall Street Journal's Jennifer Maloney has been covering this story. She spoke with the commissioner yesterday. Jennifer, welcome. What did the commissioner tell you?
Well, he considers teen use to have reached epidemic levels, and he says he needs to take action. The FDA previously had allowed e-cigarette manufacturers to keep all their existing products on the market for a few years as the FDA began a process to begin regulating e-cigarettes. But he says he's going to have to reconsider that and potentially pull all flavored e-cigarettes off the market.
Wow. So tell me what the research says about this so-called epidemic that the commissioner is describing. The CDC said in 2017 that more than 2 million middle school and high school students had used them in a 30-day period.
According to the CDC, there was a slight uptick in teen use of e-cigarettes between 2016 and 2017. Dr. Gottlieb at the FDA says that the FDA has seen preliminary data showing that there's an acceleration in teen use of e-cigarettes over the past year, but they haven't released those numbers yet.
And so why is that happening? What are teens saying about what's so attractive about these e-cigarettes?
We've been hearing lots of anecdotal reports from school districts, teachers, public health officials that e-cigarettes, and particularly the most popular brand, Juul, have become a teen status symbol. Hmm. Kids are vaping in classrooms or being confiscated by schools. And we're seeing reports of many, many young people getting hooked on these highly addictive nicotine-containing e-cigarettes.
And the argument that the FDA is making is that when you flavor the nicotine, the liquid in that nicotine that the kids are vaping with mango or cucumber that it makes it specifically targeted to those kids. Is that right?
Dr. Gottlieb, when I spoke to him yesterday, said that certain flavors appeal to kids. The FDA already has begun cracking down on some flavors that look to be specifically targeting young people, like cotton candy and other packaging that really looks like a kid product. More broadly, though, they're now looking at taking all flavored e-cigarette products off the market, leaving only products that would be flavored like tobacco.
Wow. So what are you hearing from the e-cigarette makers? You mentioned Juul. It's a startup that grew very, very quickly, almost overnight. It now has 72% of the e-cigarette market. Are those companies concerned that this could just wipe them out?
Juul says that they will work with the FDA. They say that their products are intended for adult cigarette smokers looking to switch away from cigarettes onto something less harmful. It is interesting to note that after the FDA's announcement this morning, the big tobacco companies' stocks increased. And that's an indication that investors see these startups, particularly Juul, as taking market share from the big tobacco companies. And this crackdown on Juul and other e-cigarette makers could actually help traditional tobacco.
Jennifer Maloney with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And now a warning, our next story contains some adult subjects and drug references because we're talking about the new film MDMA. Yes, that's the synthetic club drug ecstasy. And in the film, a young woman named Angie Wong discovers it in college in the 80s. She's the daughter of an overworked Chinese restaurant laborer in New Jersey. Her mom left both of them years earlier. Angie gets a chance to escape her working class life and attend a prestigious college in San Francisco, a world of privilege. But when her financial aid is suddenly cut, she uses her smarts and her access to the college chemistry lab to make ecstasy, or X. In this scene, she offers some to a frat boy date.
Primo X, made by my loving hands.
You're the mystery X goddess.
Guilty.
Oh my god, all my friends at USC and SMU, everybody knows about you. You are a celebrity.
But Angie's manufactured world starts to crumble. Ultimately, she'll grow up, get a good job in Silicon Valley. But in college, she ends up a boozy dancer in a cage above the club crowd. May sound like a college version of Breaking Bad, but Angie Wong is real, and this is her story. MDMA's writer-director Angie Wong joins us from NPR West, the studios in Culver City. Angie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I'm blown away. This is really your life. You are suddenly jettisoned to this high-end school?
Yeah, you know, I think going to college is always a huge transition for anyone, especially if you come from, you know, sort of a more modest background. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of lost my way for a while. It probably happens to a lot of kids sort of from underprivileged backgrounds.
There is that storyline, which is, as you say, very common. But I don't know how many of them can make MDMA ecstasy in the college lab. Describe this person you became as you were dealing with all of these, you know, demons from the past. We see the flashbacks that you say is a deadlift from your childhood.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You know, it's funny, you know, I've been in therapy for like 1,000 years, and my therapist, I remember one of the questions she asked me was like, did you think that you were above the law? Did you think that rules didn't apply to you? And I was like, oh, you're trying to find out if I'm a sociopath. And I thought about it really long and hard, and I said, you know, I think I was just running so fast and so hard to try to get away from myself, and I wasn't really thinking, and I wasn't paying attention to the rules, and I was just sort of blasting along very recklessly.
Well, it looks like there was a stepdad or a friend of your mother's who abused you. She didn't believe you.
No, I think that's pretty common too. So yeah. I wanted to be pretty authentic and disclose that in the movie and in my interviews, because I do some work with at-risk middle school kids, and I think it happens with alarming frequency to a lot of young women. And often the families are in disbelief or they're gaslighted. We need to bring this out into the light and to make it okay for these young women to come forward.
Well, not only that, your dad drank most nights, very cool to you, you know, unemotional with you. And you say domestic violence and alcoholism are the Asian Americans' dirty secrets, and you wanted to shed some light.
I think they are. You know, I mean, I think we're like a lot of cultures where, you know, you put up a wall and you're like, we don't tell our business outside of the house. And I think that that type of silence, that kind of shame, that kind of isolation is what becomes really toxic. Yeah. So I think it's important to just be honest and have like honest dialogue around it.
Especially it feels as if there's an element, and it might apply to other ethnic groups, but there's an element of you're expected to be the good Asian minority in so many ways. Smart. I mean, there you are in the lab making MDMA. And you offset that with this wild nightlife, you know, sort of refusing to just be that.
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's a lot of pressure, I think, especially in our culture, to live up to that model minority kind of stereotype. You know, it's funny because I'm close to a lot of my cousins, and a lot of them went on to go to medical school. And, you know, they were in Chinese, it's called guai, which means like obedient and good. And we actually, just for giggles, decided to make a list of the most guai to the most buguai, which is the least obedient. And I was the most buguai.
Well, so, yeah, it would seem so. But also, you didn't create this culture you stepped into. You're surrounded by these privileged white kids, largely, who are drinking and snorting everything within sight. I mean, here you had this window into this world, and it's not pretty.
No, it's not. And it's something that I also wanted to explore. You know, I really wanted to present sort of a palette of stereotypes and just peel back the layers to show that there's this solidarity to the human experience. And, you know, going to school with rich white people, at first I was like, I'm sure they don't have a care in the world. Like, how could you? You look great. You got plenty of money. You have like 9,000 bottles of shampoo and all the clothing that you can possibly wear in a lifetime. And it's funny because I've raised my daughter in that type of environment, too. And I realized really largely through her that it can be BS. You know, it's just a facade.
You mentioned you work with inner city kids, and we should say that after your life as a drug maker and dealer and after your successful career in Silicon Valley, you did go on and form a nonprofit called Grow. This is for at-risk middle school kids. In the film, there's a little girl named Bree who the character Angie Wong becomes a big sister to with the Big Sister organization. Is that part true?
That part is true. That part is true. I would say, though, what I found, and especially, you know, looking at my past through the lens of, you know, a 52-year-old woman, I realized that you really have to be super grounded if you're going to go into that work, because I meant well, but I wasn't consistent in her life. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I try to sort of impress upon people who want to go into this type of work is that you need to be super grounded and you need to really, really take good care of yourself and have boundaries.
Well, but the life that you see her living is also just heartbreaking. A drug-addicted mother, violence in the family. And it also runs parallel to the fact that here you are selling all these drugs and you're seeing a family ravaged by drugs.
Yes, yes. I think particularly during the 80s, you know, I saw crack kind of move in and just burn communities down to the ground. And we see it still today.
So there is a point in the film, and I don't want to give it away, but there's a terrible thing that happens. What you're doing, yeah, you're a legend, and isn't it great? All the college kids come to you for their ecstasy, and this is really true. But this is also a dangerous world of underground drugs you descend into. There's a very violent scene. You've told us it's not real, although someone like the character who dies in the scene did die after college. The point is, the drug underworld kills. The drug ecstasy can kill. This dangerous world that Angie Wong is getting deeper and deeper into, you know, hurts people.
It does.
How'd you stop?
Well, it becoming illegal was a big motivator.
By the way, what's the statute of limitations on all this that we're talking about?
I know my lawyer is always like, be careful what you say. But it wasn't illegal at the time. So now there was a piece of me that knew that, you know, one day I wanted to, like, have a daughter or a child and, you know, have a nice life and be respectable. And I knew that if I continued on down that path, that there was no way. And that, honestly, I mean, I say this often, I'm a girl who by rights should be dead probably 100 times, 100 different ways. So I think that there was that little voice that's probably connected to the rest of the universe or, you know, whatever you want to call it, that kept saying, that she was whispering, she was like, you better cut the doo-doo out. You know, you're going to die. You're going to die early. You know, you really need to get it together and strive for the light. So I think that voice finally won out.
How does it feel to have put it on the screen?
There are like 1,000 different emotions, I think, that I've experienced through this. But ultimately, I think at the end of the day, it makes me feel more connected to humanity. I still will pop into screenings, even though I've seen the movie like 9,000 billion times. And then I feel like I'm a little closer to those people in the audience because we have this shared experience.
And it comes at a moment where people are just shocked that people would want to see a film with Asian people in it. I'm thinking of Crazy Rich Asians, you know, which has been number one at the box office.
Yes.
Where would you say yours fits in this moment?
You know, I think I love Crazy Rich Asians. So I'm a girl who was brought up on television, and I very rarely saw, you know, Asian women. And then I think the one pretty Asian girl who I saw when I was a little kid turned out to be a prostitute. And I was like, oh, no, that's not what I want to be. So I'm thrilled to see beautiful Asians who are not prostitutes on screen.
Well, there's that.
But I think that more and more, you know, we're telling stories and we don't have to justify why we're Asian in it. And I think for me, you know, my story, obviously, it's smaller, it's grittier. But it's also, she's a fully fleshed out human being. You know, mm-hmm. She's got a lot of different compartments to her life. She's a pretty complex young woman, and I think that she's doing some horrifically awful things, but, you know, she still, at the end of the day, is striving to be a better person. And I think in this day and age, you know, I think that's our job right now, is to conjure our better angels to shout down our demons.
That's writer and director Angie Wong. Her new film, MDMA, opens in theaters and video on demand on Friday. It tells the story of her life in the 1980s. Angie Wong, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
This is Here and Now. Forces loyal to the Assad regime in Syria are continuing the bombardment of Idlib province, the last remaining rebel stronghold in the country. The airstrikes are escalating into what could be the last major battle of Syria's seven-year-long civil war. Yesterday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on Syria, Iran, and Russia to prevent a humanitarian crisis. 3 million civilians are in the path of the shelling.
It is absolutely essential to avoid a full-scale battle in Idlib. This would unleash a humanitarian nightmare unlike any seen in the blood-soaked Syrian conflict.
CNN's senior international correspondent Fred Pleitgen is in Syria. He joins us now on a Skype line. Fred, tell us where you are exactly and what you're seeing.
Hi, yeah, I'm in a village that is in the north of what's called Hama province, which borders Idlib, which is the last rebel-held stronghold in Syria. And you really get a feeling of being in a frontline town here. There's sort of artillery positions here from the Syrian government. There's a lot of Syrian government fighters here in this village. There's also a lot of villagers here who are, you know, obviously quite fearful of the situation. There was a rocket attack a couple of days ago on this village where several people died. So you do get that feeling of really being on the front line here of the civil war.
And remind us why the Syrian government sees this area as such a strategic spot in this war.
Yeah. It's really significant for two reasons, because a lot of the fighters and a lot of the civilians who left other areas are crammed up in Idlib province. So it's one of the places that the Syrian government wants back. The other reason is, and this might even be just as important, it's also home to one of the main highways through Syria that basically connects the north to the south of Syria. It's the main highway to the town of Aleppo. And certainly that's also one of the reasons strategically why they want it back as well.
There's estimates that 700,000 people could flee Idlib. But then the question is, where would they go? Turkey has already said it's very concerned about a bunch of refugees coming over in waves over their border.
That's the most difficult question, I would say. Look, the Syrian government and the Russians are saying that people could use what they call humanitarian corridors that come back into government-held territories. But there's two big problems with that. On the one hand, of course, a lot of the people who fled to Idlib province in the first place fled there because they were afraid of the Syrian government. So they're not necessarily keen to go back there. On the other hand, we also have information that apparently there's rebel groups that are stopping some of those villages in Idlib province from negotiating with the Syrian government, from negotiating with the Russians, from trying to get some sort of solution to all of this. So there really isn't any good solution for the civilians. And I think that's one of the reasons why the UN is also so concerned, because they really don't see any place where these people can go. You're right. The Turks have said that they can't take in any more people because they've already taken in 3.5 million. And certainly for a lot of those people, it seems as though they feel that going to the government areas is simply not an option for them.
Well, the Trump administration is watching this very closely. Earlier this week, National Security Advisor John Bolton said that the United States would respond to a chemical weapons attack if they occurred in Idlib. Let's listen to that.
The response of the Trump administration when we had unmistakable proof twice was to use force against the Syrian regime. We've tried to convey the message in recent days that if there's a third use of chemical weapons, the response will be much stronger.
Is there any evidence that the Syrian government is getting ready to use chemical weapons here in Idlib?
We obviously haven't seen any of that. We also haven't been on the front line very long here. Certainly the Syrian government says that it's not something that they plan to do. They say they've gotten rid of all their chemical weapons. The Russians are saying the same thing. You do notice, however, how all of that is really becoming a political football, if you will. On the one hand, the Russians are already accusing rebels in Idlib province of allegedly staging false flag chemical attacks to try and draw America into the conflict. And then you have U.S. side saying that they believe that the Assad government might be preparing something. So you really see some of the big powers around this conflict really getting into a battle of words over this whole thing in anticipation of what might happen when the battle begins.
And there's no doubt the Syrian government wants this war to be over. You did some fascinating reporting earlier about a government-sponsored trade fair in Damascus to attract businesses to Syria after the war, and we have some sound from that.
Even as airstrikes indicate an offensive on the last major rebel-held area may be imminent, the Syrian government is inviting international businesses back to the country, putting on its largest trade fair since the civil war started. The organizers say representatives from almost 50 countries are attending.
The juxtaposition there is absolutely fascinating. Fred, is there a feeling in Damascus that this really is the end of the war and that life could just so simply return back to normal?
Look, from being in Damascus, I do think that many people in Damascus think that this is very much at least the beginning of the end of the war. There's a lot more cafes, there's a lot more shops. Obviously, they do realize that there is a lot to do and there really isn't any money there to do that. Now, that fair, I think it's sort of an appeal that they're making. Well, at the same time, a lot of people in the Syrian government are also, you know, trying to put a brave face on it and saying, we'll rebuild in either way, whether the West wants to help or not. But of course, they also are well aware of the fact that they really don't have the resources to do that.
That's CNN's senior international correspondent Fred Pleitgen outside of Idlib as the Syrian government prepares its last fight against the rebels there in that area. Fred, thank you very much for your time. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.